We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're back once more with Julio Rosas. He is a senior writer at Town Hall, and he's also out with a new book with one of the best titles, I think, ever. Fiery, but mostly peaceful, the 2020 riots and the gaslighting of America. Julio is truly one of my favorite reporters to follow in recent years because he gets the most incredible stuff on camera and in places where there's so little media coverage. Julio, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we had you, I think, last in 2020 or 2021 to talk about your experience that summer, the summer of the George Floyd riots, in which you were everywhere, all over the country. It seemed like you were sleepless, indefatigable, and all of that. But you had to reflect on all of those experiences for this book. And I'm wondering if that sort of made you think about the experience in any different ways, or did you sort of come to any realizations about what you experienced that year in 2020 in particular, as you were looking back on it and putting it all together in a book?
You know, it's kind of funny. Obviously, there was a lot of reflection to go into this because I really had to think deep and try to, really remember what was happening, and as I've told you before, that these are very whirlwind experiences, and there's actually not a lot of time to process in the heat of it. And so, I mean, what I would say is kind of the things I really took away from me is just kind of the sad reality and just kind of the sad acceptance that what we know to be a society, a civilized society, can easily go away within a couple of days, and that's not exactly a good thing to have happened, but that's what happened. I mean, Minneapolis, the very first riot that I covered, was the epitome of that, and that was really the one that I personally covered, where it was the Wild West with more fire, I guess you could say, but it was very much a very chaotic time. And part of the reason for the book, or I should say a big reason for the book, is to have a written oral history on that year, especially because a lot of the powers to be within the political world and the media world, they want the rest of the country to have a very distorted view on these riots because of who was perpetuating them, right? Like Black Lives Matter, Antifa, and things of that nature. And so I really wanted to just make sure that people understood, like, hey, these were riots. These were destructive. People were hurt by them, innocent people, and they happened. And it's sad that it has to be the basic of this riot happened, but it's only because a lot of people don't want to acknowledge the damage that was done.
Your takeaway that you mentioned early in that answer is really fascinating to me, because you would get to a lot of these places early, sort of as soon as you got an inkling from, I'm assuming, local Antifa groups, local BLM groups, that something was going down, you'd get there. So you got to sort of see that process play out, whether in Minneapolis or Portland. And I'm wondering how the sort of breakdown of that social order occurred. Like, what does that look like in practice? Is it people physically taking over spaces with manpower that the police aren't able to or aren't willing to push back on? How does the social order crumble so quickly amid pressure from these sort of professional activists?
Generally they put a call out on social media, and so that's how I was able to kind of predict where things would take place. And but once you're there, I mean, so this is actually kind of an interesting, because they didn't start rioting as soon as they gathered, right? It took a little time for that to reach that point, and sometimes it took just one instance of police trying to crack down, or multiple instances, but that was one of the problems in Portland, for example. So at the federal courthouse, we all knew that the whole reason why people were gathering outside the public park that was right across the street from the federal courthouse was because that they were going to riot later in the night. But because we have, thankfully, our First Amendment right to peacefully assemble, the police couldn't crack down on that right away. And so, but it was then when the crowd turned into rioters, that's when police were able to respond. But it kind of brings up a kind of an interesting, I guess, legal case to where, you know, can police crack down on a crowd that is 100% known going to turn violent? And that gets a little hairy, right? I mean, I think I'm going to go on the side of, you know, no, let's let them have their space until they turn violent. Then you can go ahead and do that. But that was a constant problem that Portland had when you have these groups consistently putting the call out on social media and in their chats to gather, and then from there they then launch their attack. So that was a kind of a constant problem for them. But I mean, generally it was very much it did play out that way. People would gather in large groups. They would get angry. They get riled up. And in every case that I personally covered, it was always the rioters making the first move, not the police. And that was kind of that's kind of another justification or putting it in context that the pro-BLM people like to claim is that, well, actually the cops were rioting and the cops were the first one to do the action. And I'm not saying that there weren't, thousands of demonstrations at their place. I'm not saying police didn't overreact in some instances, but in all the riots that I personally covered, it was always rioters making the first move and police responding to that violent action.
And fiery, but mostly peaceful. That was from Minneapolis, am I right?
No, that's from Kenosha.
Oh, that was from Kenosha. Okay, cool. Yeah. And so tell us, I mean, I think the value of using that as the title of the book is sort of very obvious to some of us. But for folks like me who perhaps don't remember the precise moment that happened, looking back on the fiery but mostly peaceful quote, why do you think it is so representative of the way the media and the political establishment treated the riots over the course of that summer?
It was that Chyron that ran on CNN when their own reporter was in the middle of the riot in Kenosha, and I was there that night. I didn't see CNN, but I was there that night, and it was like, yeah, it was very much a chaotic night. It wasn't mostly peaceful, but it was their attempt really to just trying to sanitize what was going on. Now, of course, it's ridiculous to try to do that when, again, right behind their own reporter, Omar Jimenez, there's things on fire and there's damage and there's smoke in the air and all this, there's sirens going off in the background. So I think it shows kind of the hubris and the confidence that the mainstream media has in thinking that they can sway public opinion on whatever the current thing is, even though, again, when it's bashed up against a reality that's so hard to ignore when you're actually seeing things for yourself. And it stems from just them always having that control on smaller things. I mean, the riots and the coverage of them is far from the latest or the only example of mainstream media trying to distort things because it puts the left in an unfavorable light. I mean, that's their mantra. But they're able to get away with things a lot easier. Like, for example, the Florida's, don't say gay bill, when that was a complete false way of portraying things. And it was just strictly from the left's talking point about the bill. It had nothing to do with that. But that was easier for them to get away with because a lot of people didn't even read the bill, number one. But even when it comes to then the corporations backing the left's narrative on that. So that is an example of them having an easier time controlling that narrative. But it's so much harder for them to try to do that when entire communities are being ravaged by BLM rioters and looters. But that doesn't mean they're not going to try. And they definitely did. And even today, when we talk about this, especially in the aftermath of January 6th, which I also cover in the book because I was there covering that, that's the only riot that matters to them in their eyes. And so before they were trying to ignore the BLM riots, they were trying to justify them. But now they say, well, okay, yes, there might have been some riots maybe in 2020, but none of that matters because January 6th happened. And in my view, all riots matter, especially when it comes to accurate retelling our nation's history.
So I actually think now I was remembering Ali Velshi in Minneapolis. He had a sort of fiery but mostly peaceful moment in Minneapolis. What was Minneapolis is an interesting example because, as you said earlier, it really was the first, obviously because of George Floyd, it was really the first place that this took off. How disconnected was the media coverage from what happened in Minneapolis? And, you know, now that you have almost 2 years in the rearview mirror, which is kind of crazy to think about, what sort of signs were there at the time that this could turn into a very, very dangerous and bloody summer?
So, yes, the MSNBC, interestingly enough, and I did talk about Ali Velshi in the book because he said that this is not generally speaking an unruly protest as a building is burning right directly behind him. And then he goes, well, fires have been started. It's like, yeah, no, duh. It's been going on for over an hour. I don't know what you're talking about. But Craig Melvin, actually, and this is something that I point to in the book. Craig Melvin, who was an anchor, I think he left fairly recently, but he was an anchor on MSNBC, and he tweeted out probably by day two or day three of the riots happening in Minneapolis by saying that we're not gonna call these riots, we're gonna call these demonstrations with some aspects of unrest, and that's kind of the. And it seemed like that was, the way that he phrased the tweet made it seem like it was official MSNBC or potentially NBC editorial guidance on how to cover this. And again, that's just not what happened. And in the book, I recount my last night in Minneapolis, and this is by things had calmed down significantly. So riots broke out on Monday, and this is Sunday. This is Sunday evening. And I was watching a bunch of protesters who had broken curfew turn into a little bit of rioting against the police. But the police had the manpower to really crack down on people who were out past curfew. And I actually saw Ali Velshi also, you know, covering this circumstance that was happening in front of us. And in the moment, I wanted to kind of confront him about why did you say this a couple of days ago? But I didn't want to cause a scene. And I was also admittedly very mentally beat and tired. And I just didn't, I just wanted to ignore that. But looking back on that, I kind of wish I did say something to him. And not to say that that would have then changed the media narrative, but it was to, you know, call him out in person and say, hey, what you said was stupid and it was just objectively wrong. And, you know, you deserve all the criticism you got. But the reason why I wish I did is because as things continued, the media kept doubling down on that. Basically that MSNBC directive of not calling them riots and trying everything they could to justify it, put it in context or whatever. And so in terms of the signs from Minneapolis, if that was going to continue, I genuinely believed that things were going to stop very shortly after things calmed down in Minneapolis. When I was there on that Friday, when things started to spread to other cities, that's, you know, Atlanta, New York City, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles. But I thought, okay, we're going to have this kind of week, maybe 2 weeks of things getting out of hand, and then we're going to go back to normal because there's going to be a big response, a big law enforcement and even military response to this. But that's not what happened, right? I mean, things continued on for months. So I changed my mindset from, oh, this is going to not happen anymore relatively soon to, are these things ever going to stop? And that was a kind of a scary, or very worrying time for me personally, just because, you know, when you constantly go to these things, you wonder how sustainable it is. And it's not sustainable at all. And really our saving grace was winter. And, you know, as much as the radicals like to talk about revolution and overthrowing the United States government, as soon as it gets below 40 degrees, they like to stay home. But so that was kind of the thinking. That was the evolution for me personally as I was going out throughout that year.
Of course, many of our listeners are parents, so I want to let you guys know, parents, it is time to finally cross off one of the most important things on your to-do list. Life insurance. Fabric makes getting a great term life insurance policy for your family quick, easy, and surprisingly affordable. Fabric was built specifically for parents to help you manage your family's financial future like a parenting pro, stress-free. Fabric's new lower prices mean significant savings over other providers with great policies like $1 million in coverage for less than $1 a day. Everything's also on your schedule with Fabric because it's all online. How convenient is that? Less than 10 minutes to apply, and you could be offered coverage instantly with no health exam required. Then just personalize your quote to fit your family's needs, and you'll be set with high-quality, affordable protection for your family. What a weight off your shoulders. Fabric is fully backed by Vantas Life, one of the most trusted names in life insurance since 1847, so you can feel confident when you're getting a high-quality policy that meets your family's needs. With Fabric's online hub, it's quick and easy to track your family finances all in one place. Get fast, affordable life insurance, create a will for your family, set up your kids' college savings plan, and even establish a rainy day savings fund. Planning for the future has never been easier. There's no risk to apply today either. Fabric has a 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can cancel at any time. So protect your family with term life insurance now in just 10 minutes. Apply today at meetfabric.com/Federalist. That's meetfabric.com/Federalist to start protecting your family today. M-E-E-T, fabric.com/Federalist. Fabric Insurance Agency policies issued by Vantas Life, not available in New York and Montana. Prices subject to underwriting and health questions. How much do you think easing of COVID restrictions also contributed to sort of neutering the intensity of the protests, since people had more opportunities to go, the restaurants were reopening, there was more work in sort of that world? Do you think that played a role at all? I'm just thinking of this question now as we're talking.
I'm not entirely sure. I will say with confidence that the lockdowns and the effects that had definitely was a contributing factor, because since 2021, where a lot of things were basically open last year, there have been things that I thought would have sparked some riots, but haven't. And I would say, yeah, and thinking about it right now, actually, I think that would be a factor, because when we look at the disastrous effects the lockdowns had, I mean, we put people out of work. We kept people cooped up in their homes for weeks on end. And with the goalposts kept moving, oh, with two more weeks. And so that there was a buildup to that. And I think 2020 was a very unique year, because not only did we have COVID and the panic over that, just because, you know, at the time we didn't know exactly what we were dealing with. We also had a presidential election with the president that is hated very strongly by a large part of the American population. And then when we add the spark of what happened to George Floyd, I mean, so it was kind of like a triangle of circumstances. And so going back to what I was saying in 2021, we didn't necessarily have those conditions. And so when we look to the future, I think, you know, anything can happen at any time. These things are very fluid, and they can happen kind of overnight. But there does need to be some sort of circumstances that put kind of extra pressure on people to kind of make them act out in a way that they maybe not act if things were different. If COVID didn't happen in 2020, you know, maybe we wouldn't have to the extent of the damage that we saw that year.
The head of the Democratic Party, President Joe Biden, has recently said in his State of the Union address, actually, you know, that we are not the party of defunding the police, or we're not going to defund the police, something to that effect. And I'm really curious of what you think, Julio, that sort of climate where the establishment of the Democratic Party is, you know, I remember Jacob Frey in Minneapolis getting booed out of this massive demonstration in the middle of the street because he wouldn't go all the way towards abolishing the police. And it did seem like even the Democratic establishment in 2020 had been cowed into flirting with some radical ideas about police reform. And in that climate, it seemed like police were sort of being, they were being lenient because politicians wanted them to be. They didn't want to crack down on demonstrations because Jacob Frey wouldn't want that to reflect on him, reflect on the Democratic Party. So in this new climate where the head of the party is the sort of establishment figure saying, we're not going to defund the police, do you think that this would riots of this level would still be able to break out despite the sort of shift in the party narrative?
I mean, potentially. First off, that's a ridiculous assertion by Biden. Just simply because they seem the polling on what actually happens when people's security are taken away, and it's disastrous. I mean, we're seeing the effects of the rhetoric of defunding and abolishing the police. There's no fear anymore. And why would they be? Because even if they're arrested, if people are arrested for some pretty serious crimes, we have progressive DAs, again, under this veneer of social justice and racial equity, they get out, let out with no bond or very little bond, and then they go out and commit more crimes. And this is, it's not Republicans who are doing this in deep red states. These are overwhelmingly happening in Democratic controlled cities. And so I think, the reason why Biden is saying that today is just, again, because it looks like they're going to be absolutely just decimated in the midterms as one of the factors, because, when it comes to economic security, physical security also is pretty high on that list for obvious reasons. But it was very hysterical to see the White House last year trying to pin, Republicans are the party that wanted to fund the police, when 2020, that's all they talked about nonstop with the Democrats, especially the more vocal squad, progressive wing. But even, I pointed an example to this in the book, even just a non serious or not non-serious, but just a resolution on the House floor to just, that was put forth by Republicans in the House to say, hey, we just want to say we support police officers, and we're not for them being attacked violently by people. And Democrats shot that down in the House. So this wasn't a bill. This wasn't for funding. This is just a statement, and they couldn't even bring themselves to vote for that. And I think that's very telling. It's ridiculous. It's the gaslighting that I talk about. That's in the headline, in the title, just because this is plain for anybody to see. But again, I guess just because they're so used to controlling the narrative or having an easier time controlling the narrative, they're just going to continue running that same playbook. It's just harder. It's just harder for them to win against that, because real people all across this country saw what happened.
Yeah, it did really seem like that climate of sort of fear of the left wing in this very heated media moment led to some really bad decision making among local lawmakers, national lawmakers, and then trickled down into the police forces. And on that note, I don't think I've ever asked you, Julio, before, as you observed police in so many different cities around the country in that summer, attempting to react and control the situation, I imagine there were major differences from, say, Portland to Kenosha or anywhere else. Maybe there weren't. But what did you see from police who were attempting to quell these demonstrations, in different cities?
So the frontline guys, they took a lot of abuse. I'm not even just talking about verbally, but physically. And it just depended on the situation, also depending on the time, just because, again, for example, with the federal courthouse in Portland, at the time, the local police department, the Portland Police Bureau, they were barred from helping DHS protect their courthouse, because technically, the Federal Protective Service's jurisdiction to protect the courthouse and they're carrying out their mission only extends so far. So whenever they would push back the Antifa rioters away from the courthouse, the federal officers would pull back. Mm. Generally, that is when the local jurisdiction would then step in to prevent the crowd from going back. But because the city leaders prevented them from even communicating with DHS officers, let alone physically help them, the rioters just came back. And so it just became kind of this back and forth ping pong play out into the early morning hours. And so that later changed into 2021, when the ICE station in Portland was attacked, whenever the federal officers pushed back the rioters, Portland police then were allowed to help and continue, you know, push people further away. And it was effective. I mean, that was the thing, that was an effective tactic and strategy. But because the Portland courthouse siege was somehow Trump's fault, it's somehow DHS's fault, Portland, the city of Portland said, no, we're not going to help with that. And so they're culpable in that destruction, in that violence, and they've gotten away with it. Hmm. You know, I mean, there's no accountability for that. For Kenosha, I mean, that was a situation where this is a blue collar town. This is not a huge city by any stretch of the imagination. So the police were very, the local police department was very much caught unprepared by this. And so I very much blame, again, the leaders of the locality, and more importantly on Tony Evers, the Democratic governor mm-hmm. of Wisconsin, because initially he only called up 150 National Guardsmen after the first riot, which is not nearly enough to actually secure key locations to free up officers to carry out law enforcement duties.
How obvious to you was it at the time that 150 was like clearly insufficient?
I mean, I just read just by viewing the videos from the night prior and from being on the ground on the second day, just looking around and seeing the crowd, and it was growing by a minute. And this is, you know, the Kenosha, part of the reason why Kenosha got so out of hand is because people were coming as far away as Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And then you also have Milwaukee and Chicago. So you have three very big cities with very riled up people coming in from out of town. And obviously some local residents also rioted alongside, but Tony Evers has said, well, that's as much we could call up on such a short notice. And that is true, yes, but also this is far from the first riot that had occurred during that year. We had 2 months prior to all this. And so it's not just him, but all the other governors across the entire country, maybe Alaska would be the only exception, but they should have really looked at, okay, hey, this is something that's still continuing. This is something that's still happening. We need to look at our quick reaction forces and our military police units or whoever that we're going to call up and make sure they're trained up and ready to go because it's still happening. But I think there was a reluctance to do that because, again, they would then be calling up the National Guard on BLM rioters, which is something the Democratic governors probably didn't want that visual. And so it is a little bit circumstantial evidence right there, but you just have to look at the climate and what they were saying.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's just, it's sad. I mean, it really is sad that it reached that point where we're prioritizing the optics of politics over people's lives and livelihoods.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to put yourself back in the shoes. It's probably not hard for you, but just it is hard to remember exactly how loaded every single hour of every single day felt during that summer as these situations were unfolding in different cities. It was just so charged. You know, every second of that summer was so charged. And I guess I'm also curious, and I'm sure a lot of people are too, what proportion of rioters were sort of part of Antifa or Antifa aligned BLM movements, how many of them were just sort of organic members of the community? And again, I imagine that differs from city to city, but in general, what did the characteristics of the rioters in different cities look like?
Yeah, so it very much depends on the location, but it also depends on the timing. So as time would go on, more and more Antifa types would show up at events. And again, with Kenosha being a prime example. So that first night, it was mostly people from Wisconsin, people from Kenosha who were outraged over the justified police action against Jacob Blake. But as the days progressed and more people were coming in from out of town, like I was saying before, that's when you'd see more people not just simply using like a red bandana to cover their face. They would be in all black attire or what have you. Same thing kind of happened in Louisville. I covered that riot after the officers were not charged for any wrongdoing in Breonna Taylor's death during that whole situation. And so because there was buildup, because they were expecting the the decision to be reached at any time. So people had time to gather, people had time to prepare. And we saw that because there's that U-Haul. We got a video of that U-Haul that was pulled up alongside a march, and they got out all these shields and banners that had Antifa symbols on them. So it just depended on the location, because obviously if you're in the Pacific Northwest, a large majority of those riders are going to be in those dedicated Antifa groups. But it also depended on just how long and how extensive the riots would go on for. And Minneapolis was very similar to that, because when I was there that Thursday night, the crowd demographic shifted from during the day, where, you know, during the day it was people who weren't necessarily hiding their identities, older people of the community. There were church groups out there trying to spread, you know, messages of peace and love and all that. And then as soon as the sun set and those people left for you know, because they knew the war was coming, that's when we saw the younger groups come out. I mean, I remember I was looking at my phone for a little bit, trying to, you know, talk to town hall and get videos and just kind of prepare. And I remember looking at my phone for a while, and I look up and I saw that shift and change in how the crowd looked. And I just thought, oh, okay, so this is going to turn crazy here. And about 20 minutes later, it did.
So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure. But as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this. And when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great. And right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza. So you can get buy one, get one free price on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also, the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98, and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotiony feel either. Every set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths. So you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty. Those Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows, you can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/federalist. Bed sheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/federalist or call 800-794-8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist. I have this sort of theory, and I really only saw these in Washington, D.C. I didn't travel at all like you did, Julio. But I sort of have this theory that There's a similarity in the motivation behind storming the Capitol on January 6th. And I want to shift to January 6th after this question, although it sort of applies here as well. And the institutional distrust that sent a lot of especially young people into the streets in 2020, because when you are sort of saturated and you grow up in a country where every institution is telling you that, you know, every interaction you have with a white person is charged with implicit bias and racism, and all of our institutions are systemically racist, it sort of makes sense that you would riot. I mean, you feel so deeply disenfranchised, and I would say inaccurately, you feel so inaccurately disenfranchised, but it's what's being told to you by institutions. In the same way that if you genuinely believe that Congress is stealing an election from the American people out under your nose, you might be inclined to storm the Capitol and riot in that place. I guess I'm just curious as to how much institutional distrust you think, and this is not to express sympathy for anyone, just merely understanding of what sort of sent people into the streets or into the Capitol. How much institutional distrust is motivating this civil unrest around the country?
I think it's definitely playing a big role. I mean, what we have a saying in the Marine Corps, shit rolls downhill. and that was definitely the case in 2020 and going into 2021, because when we look at, again, the different responses to those two big events, January 6th and the BLM riots. I mean, when people see on one side, when people on one side see the other side being able to just constantly get away with a lot of stuff and not get as cracked down, and you know, there was a lot of it. Maybe I'm not saying all the riots were completely avoidable, but I think a lot of it was made worse because of the hesitancy and the political considerations that were taken, because again, it was who was rioting and who it was against. But and so when they see that happen, and then they think, okay, well, if they can get away with it largely, then we can get away with it. And I think that was one of the factors with what led into for January 6th. And again, I'm not saying that's not justified or anything, but again, yeah, it's, you have to understand where people are coming from so that we can try to avoid further situations like this. And that's why, again, when it comes to the broken window theory, right, these things escalate. If you really don't, and I talked to former Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf, and he for the book, and he told me that if you don't crack down on these violent things, on these violent events, other people are going to take that as tacit approval or just basically saying that, yes, you can also get away with it as well. But that's why I also kind of think it was foolhardy for January 6th rioters to think that they could do that, because yes, while as important a federal courthouse is in Portland, the Capitol building is going to be much more significant, and the federal government is going to crack down hard on you on that.
Well, so they're certifying the electoral college count.
Right, exactly. So I don't understand. So there's obviously not sound logic behind that, but clearly a lot of people felt that but also I think that, and like I said, I guess we're talking about January 6th now. A lot of people that ended up in the Capitol building, myself included, they didn't think they could get as far as they could, because you would think the security for the Capitol building during such a pivotal event in such a charged atmosphere would have better security. And it didn't. It just speaks to how just unprepared and the leadership failed in preparing the officers for that day. All I could say was, it was a riot, and maybe that could have been prevented with much better planning and execution on the part of law enforcement.
Yeah, it continues to absolutely blow my mind how January 6th snowballed. And a lot of people on the left have this total misconception that January 6th was a planned, organized riot and attempt to stop the Electoral College certification. And in fact, if you were there, Julio, and I was there too, it really, it snowballed. People just sort of realized they could get into the Capitol, and they kind of walked around, and some people were behaving egregiously. There was absolutely violence towards Capitol Police. And if you, as you looked back on this and studied it and put that together with your own experiences, to what degree was this a failure of law enforcement? And when people on the left say that this was sort of a planned, plotted insurrection, as you look back on it, you know, how does that interact? How does that theory interact with what were also very clear failures on the part of law enforcement?
It's funny. When I made my way into the rotunda, that's as far as I got on that day. I had people coming, and I have my ballistic vest and I have press in big letters. And despite that, people were coming up to me more than once asking, okay, so what's the plan? And I was like, I don't know what the plan, I just followed you guys in here reporting what you're doing. I have no idea what's going on. If you don't know, like you should, like you probably, guys probably shouldn't be in here in the first place. But that's why, as I explained in the book, I think calling it an insurrection, it gives it more credence than it deserves, just simply because the definition of a riot is much more applicable because it was so disorganized and it was so very much spur of the moment in terms of, because again, people didn't start out that day thinking they can get as far as they did. And then of course, I mean, there was that one video that has shown where in one entrance, the Capitol Police did let people in, right? But that was one door. The other places, you know, people broke in through windows and what have you. So I will say, the Capitol riot was just the weirdest riot I ever covered, just from multiple reasons. I think it does irk me though when people on the left and media and politicians all of a sudden do care about riots and, oh yeah, we do support cops now and all this stuff, when for all the previous year they were trying to discredit my work and the work of others. Because, oh, well, actually, it's the police's fault. And actually, you know, what they're doing is justified or it's OK because the ends are justifying the means. And no, it absolutely does not. And I personally don't care what anybody has to say about January 6th if they were downplaying what was happening in mainstream America throughout 2020. And if you remember, January 6th wasn't the only riot that took place that year. We had some riots happening in Portland on January 20th that I covered, and also in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, right before the Derek Chauvin verdict because of what happened to Dante Wright. And so calling January 6th a Pearl Harbor or 9/11 or all this other stuff is just so stupid. And this is why we can't even, this is why we're in such a bad place as a country, because we can't even agree on kind of the basics of what things are as they are without getting into hyperbole, without getting too emotional and getting into each other's side. So, January 6th was the weirdest riot I've ever covered to date. That's all I can say about that.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you exactly, because I remember your work from the day, you were embedded with the people who made their way into the Capitol. And I was going to ask you exactly sort of how they were reacting when they got into the Capitol, because it was a sort of stunned confusion. And on the flip side, I think there's serious plausibility to the idea that there were FBI agents implanted in the crowd that were doing some stuff to sort of gin it up. We don't know. We don't have confirmation of that. We have some evidence that was the case. And you know, that may be true to some degree. We don't know. But I think on the flip side, it's also important to say that a lot of this, you won't understand January 6th unless you understand how organic so much of it was. People just realizing, the anger built as they got closer to the Capitol. They realized they could breach the police lines. And in some places, the police were dealing with that by opening the doors to the Capitol and people got in. So would you sort of agree with that? Then the flip side, it is, you know, this was a very real outburst of frustration among very real, people who were there to protest what was happening with the election.
Yeah. When I was inside the rotunda, a lot of people were just kind of milling about. They were taking pictures because, I mean, I assume some of them had never even been in the Capitol. Well, I would say a majority of them probably had been in the Capitol in the first place. But they were also lost because, as you and I both know, having been inside the Capitol in other days, it's a pretty confusing building. It's got all these all these hallways and floors and all that sort of stuff. So if you don't really know where you're going, you can get lost pretty easily. So, I think people were, again, I think people were just surprised with how far they were able to get. And I think a good example of that is former Olympic swimmer Cleet Keller. He swam during the Michael Phelps years. He was on the same team. He was like his teammate. And he wore his Olympic swimming jacket that day. And he was easily identifiable through my videos. And I didn't know who he was. But the FBI was able to identify him because he's 6 feet, 6 inches tall. And he was easily identifiable by his Olympic swimming jacket. Now, if he were to, if that was a plan, that would be pretty stupid of him to wear that and think he could get away with it. So a lot of people were just kind of just, yeah, let's just like, we can get in. So let's just get in. And that again speaks to why weren't the Capitol Police leadership more prepared. And even Muriel Bowser, the DC mm-hmm. mayor, she rejected extra federal law enforcement help. And now she doesn't have jurisdiction over the Capitol building, but by not having extra federal law enforcement on hand, that probably delayed a response. She also only wanted, again, around 120 DC National Guardsmen activated, and they were only there for traffic duty. They were not armed. They were just there directing traffic and manning kind of those roadblocks around the city. So the actual riot response team for the National Guard didn't even get there until around, so the riot pretty much kicked off around like 1:30, 2 o'clock, and the DC National Guard riot response didn't get there until around 5:30, right? So I mean that ate up time. So there's a lot of fault in preparation for this, and I know I'm repeating myself, but this was far from the first time there was a threat of a riot. We had just come off of 2020, and so I think January 6th was the most avoidable riot, just because there's so much energy. And I'll say, look, I mean, you know, people will want to say, well, Trump incited it, and to that I would say, the day of, as people were leaving, he said, yeah, you can go to the Capitol building, just don't go inside. Like, don't be violent. Like, he, for all of his faults, he got that right. And clearly people didn't listen to him. And even before that, people were planning on doing something, right? But it just was so disorganized. And it was just idiotic. It was an idiotic attempt to try to do that. But there was just, January 6th is just, as with a lot of things, people just lose the plot about it just because it's just so charged and it's so political. And again, for me, it's just, you know, all riots are bad. The effects of riots are long lasting. We're seeing that now, like I said, in American cities with our crime rate, basically just like a low intensity riot. And a lot of people have died. A lot of people have died. And specifically a lot of minorities have died in this crime wave that we can trace back to this call and this really aggressive push to reform policing to the point where it's ineffective or to the point where it's non-existent in its current form today.
Right. And as someone who was actually inside the Capitol as a reporter, to be very clear, And we know the FBI has been doing sort of like geo tracing of.
They're well aware I was there.
I was going to ask if you, and your videos, of course, I'm sure have been used as evidence. So I was going to ask if they have contacted you, authorities have contacted you at all. That's good. Okay.
No, I was. So in the moment, I wasn't concerned about that because I am credentialed on Capitol Hill.
Right.
And so I think that's part of it, but I thought, okay, I should be good. But then seeing the kind of crackdown that was happening in the days that followed, I was thinking, oh shoot, are they going to bust down my door? Mm-hmm. But to date, I mean, over a year later, they haven't come knocking, and my videos have been used as evidence, like for example against Clyde Keller, because apparently I was like one of the only ones that got him on video from that day. So. Yeah, no, the FBI knows that I was there as a reporter because that's where I was. Also, I think it was helpful that I have a very long history at that point of covering riots that I'm not trying to be like some like infiltrator or anything, but no, I will say that there have been very egregious instances. I mean, there's a friend of mine who is a freelance photographer that I covered the border crisis with. He's been targeted by the FBI. Even though he was there as a freelance reporter. And so there has been, as much as there's been, a good accountability for some of the people there, just because again, the hysteria around that day, there's been an over reaction on account of law enforcement with some individuals. So from that day, because my friend, he was there as a photographer. But he's been targeted by the FBI.
I want to end by asking you, Julio, to expand on a point you actually just made, which is the social order, as you document in the book, Firing Mostly, But Mostly Peaceful, collapses very quickly. And we saw that clearly happen in different cities. That experiment played out. We know the social order is very fragile. What have the long-term consequences looked like for some of those communities, whether it's Kenosha or Louisville or Portland, wherever it is? How did the rapid collapse of the social order, how has that continued to affect those communities now with almost 2 years in some cases in the rearview mirror?
So trauma for the local residents is still very there. I interviewed the owner of eye doctor's office in New York City that was ransacked. And she made the point to say that we're not just a store, we are a medical facility, and our patients couldn't access their medical services because they had, first they were closed down because of the COVID lockdowns. For about 3 months, and then they had opened probably about 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and then the riots happened, and they were closed for another 2 months because they had to repair and replace all the lost inventory. And so people were out of luck with getting their eye needs met, and then but also just the trauma of this can happen again, because clearly the police were overwhelmed and they couldn't save them. They couldn't save their livelihood at that point. And it goes beyond just the crime, but there's also the economic factors. In Kenosha, when I went to interview one business owner, I noticed that a car shop that was right next to her tire shop,
yes,
was empty. And I asked her, what happened to them? And they said, oh, well, he moved out of town.
Yeah. Was that the used car lot?
No, okay. this wasn't the one that's like the famous with all the burnt out cars.
Okay.
It was a couple streets over, but okay. So the businesses, not all, but the ones that were able to make a comeback, they didn't necessarily make a comeback in the exact same spot, because why would they? Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything was gone in the blink of an eye. So yeah, maybe go to another locality or another county. And hopefully your business can survive if something were to happen there. So there's a stigma. There's a stigma that some places still face, and for obvious reasons, because if you look at Minneapolis, the crime rate there is absolutely soared. It's reached complete new heights, just because, again, people know they can get away with a lot these days. And so we are in so much of a worse place than we were in 2020 when it comes to actually trying to solve these very, very complicated and these very charged issues. And that's just, again, because politics has played a role. The fringe minorities, but are very loud, have a lot of sway on these Democratic politicians. And so I don't know where we're going as a country, but we're not headed anywhere good. And the recent, for example, like the recent Supreme Court leak about Roe versus Wade,
right,
and the reaction to all that. It's just another example of that. I mean, Los Angeles just had not so much a riot, but a giant street brawl between pro-abortion protesters and police. And so it's just a lot of people believe, and maybe correct to a certain extent, that they can get what they want through violence, as long as it's justified with the powers to be, with corporations and the media and Democratic politicians. So. We're in a scary time, and I really hate to sound like the kind of doom and gloom end of the world type preacher deal, but the reason why I feel that way is just because I've seen the effects of this online outrage spilling over into the streets. And when we look at, and when I was looking at the aftermath in these cities, that possibility is still very real. So it like I said, it builds up over time, and there has to be certain conditions in place to for that spark to then make an outburst, but it's going to happen at some point. I mean, this is far from the first time we've had widespread riots in this country. So I don't know what's going to be. I don't know when that's going to be. I don't know what's going to be those conditions and what's going to cause it. But I just think we're going to be in a worse position to respond to that next level of an outburst when it does happen.
Just an amazing service that you did over the course of 2020 and all of the hard work that you put into making sure, as you said, this is written down in history. There's a written record of the history of 2020 because it was so poorly covered by those journalists who like to think they are doing the first draft of history. They're writing the first draft of history in the legacy press. So Julio Rosas, really, really appreciate your time today and all of the hard work you do at Town Hall.
Thank you.
Of course. Well, the book is Fiery But Mostly Peaceful, The 2020 Riots and the Gaslighting of America. That was released on May 3rd, so you can get your copy right now. Highly recommend you follow Julio and all of his work at Town Hall. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the...